This is Nicholas Lemon. Welcome to the Underreported Podcast. We're back with John Judas, author of The Socialist Awakening, What's Different Now About the Left, our latest book from Columbia Global Reports. As I briefly mentioned in our last episode, John Judas has brought out a book with Columbia Global Reports during each of the last three national political seasons, the populist explosion in 2016, the nationalist revival in 2018, and now the socialist awakening. Together, these books have charted a rise of a new and unexpected political mood produced by widespread dissatisfaction of the results of the free market policies that emerged in the late 20th century. Thank you for joining us, John.
My pleasure.
So let's start, and here I'm going to be referring maybe a little bit to all three of your books that you published with us, rather than just The Socialist Awakening. So let's start by talking about, you know, the working class, to use Marx's term. It's a long, long running story that the theory of socialism was that it would be the political ideology of the ruling class, the working class. And that's been intermittently true, at best, right?
Right.
Now you have this kind of odd finding, and you were referring to this a little bit in our last podcast. Portions of the American working class voted for Donald Trump, depending on how you define working class. Large portions of the European working class are voting for nativist, nationalist, far-right parties. Are these people, why is that happening? And is there any hope that a growing socialism could begin to bring in some of these folks as well as people, young people who live in metropolitan areas?
Well, that's a big question. Let's start out just with the idea of the working class, and then I'll sort of work my way up on that. When Marxists and the early socialists and social democrats thought of the working class, they thought of blue collar factory workers and craft workers. They really did not think of what we call white collar workers as part of the working class. But by the 1920s in the United States, the working class, so-called, had already become a minority within the broader people, wage workers. And you know what we have now is maybe 70%, 80% of the society works for wages or salaries, but they're completely divided by how much they make, by the levels of authority. You know, what we used to call professionals, many of them now work for salaries or wages. So again, it becomes difficult to imagine, as the older socialists did, a kind of homogeneous working class bound together by the same, living in the same communities, going to the same bars, having the same conception of themselves, becoming a majority of the population and voting in socialism. That really was the older idea. Now, that's really not feasible, and you have this kind of odd situation in the United States where you have an hourglass for the Democrats, where a lot of the Democratic voters are minority voters who are lower income, and a lot of them are also more in the upper middle class professionals, and then the hourglass in the middle, the so-called white working class, which includes really small business people as well, middle income, are voting for Republicans. You have a very similar thing in France. You have a very similar thing in Great Britain. So, you know, in the United States, the key event is the civil rights in the 60s. That's what starts it. But then you have an accretion of events after that. the cultural divisions over religion, over guns, the idea that the Democrats and liberals, by being the party of redistribution, are really interested mostly in this lower part of the hourglass and not in the middle. That the social programs are not going to go to the working class, so-called, the middle part, but it's going to go to the lower part, to minorities. And the Republicans are able to drive a wedge in American politics between the lower and middle parts of the society. And that's really the, that's the basis of their coalition, is primarily white wage workers, plus the farmers, plus business. Whereas the Democrats now lower, plus upper middle. And the key to American politics, to having a real left, is being able to reunite those various segments and to end the kind of divisions between white and black, white and Hispanic, and the middle and the lower. So that's what, that should be the goal. How to do that is very difficult.
You, some years ago, before Columbia Global Reports existed, published a book called The Emerging Democratic Majority, which has been described, or you might say caricatured, as saying the Democrats can't lose over the long term just on sort of demographic issues. That is, they don't have to think about getting back the white working class or wage earners, because minority voters are so loyal to them and they're a growing part of the country. So can you square that with
I'm looking at my bookcase to see if I have to quote you from the actual book.
I know that page
66. Our theory was completely vulgarized. I mean, what we argued was that as long as the Democrats could retain a significant proportion of their older New Deal white, again, primarily white vote, which is about, again, we estimated about 40%. Now it's much, they have to just get 35%. But we say this in the book, that plus minorities, plus women, plus professionals would give them a majority. And they did that in 2006 and 2008, but they lost a lot of those voters beginning in 2010. And that's really what sunk the ship from then on. Obama got some back in the Midwest. But again, Biden's main strength so far has been his increased support among the so-called white working class, which pollsters define as people without a four-year college degree. That's really where he's made the biggest inroads, not among suburbanites, which is the usual, upper middle class suburbanite, which is the usual take on why the Democrats are doing so well. So our theory was always you had to retain that. My mistake was that in 2008, I got optimistic about Obama, and I thought that he might be in the same position as Roosevelt, and that by getting us through the Great Recession, he could keep those voters and build a lasting majority. It just didn't work out that way.
Now, a lot of people, especially in my neighborhood, Upper West Side of New York, would say, well, the answer to that is simple. Those voters are just racist. Your comment on that?
All Americans are racist, I mean, in a sense. I mean, we're complex human beings. And these kind of sentiments get brought to the fore in certain circumstances and certain politicians. And Trump has been brilliant at emphasizing those kind of issues and bringing the dark side of America to the fore. A lot of the people who voted for him voted for Obama. In South Carolina, Tim Scott, a black guy, a Republican, he does fine. Those same voters don't worry about him being a black man. So again, in Trump's characterization of America and its divisions, he really does bring out our racist side. And he drives home these kind of divisions that go back to the 60s between white and black, and also over Latinos, the same kind of thing. So I reject this idea that there are some Americans who are just intrinsically racist. Of course there there's an alt-right of 20,000 people that are impossible, just like there's an alt-left that want to burn down every town in America. But that's not America, and we're much more complicated people than that.
As you look back on the previous two books in this series, the populist book and the nationalist book, how do you think they stand up? Have you changed your mind about any of those issues? Is anything, I don't know if you've gone back and looked at them again, but I'm just curious how those words strike you now.
Well, I think we're in a period where populism might be in abeyance in Europe. And I think you and I talked about this in the very first book talk I gave. And what I said then was that there comes a time when societies are in crisis, when a lot of the leadership looks and says, oh my God, we can't continue with Donald Trump. We can't have the alternative for Deutschland being the main opposition party. And they move over a little and to some extent coalesce against them. And you get an advance in politics. You get the absorption of some of those ideas, but not others. And we may be seeing that happening in the United States with the Never Trumpers and with Biden accepting the idea again of economic patriotism, which comes out of Trump in 2016. So we might have a degree of Trump populism, but not Trump. And that's the goal. It's not to have necessarily a populist America, but for some of those ideas to be accepted. And that's the relationship between the old populists in America and Huey Long and FDR. That's what they did. So you look to some extent to a period of co-optation. Germany, I think that's happening again by virtue of the way Merkel handled the coronavirus. France is a more problematic. Britain again, Starmer, I think that's how you pronounce his name, who took over from Corbyn, has really changed the party in a way that has brought back a lot of its working class roots, and it's very promising, I think. And he might, I'm much more optimistic now even than I was when I wrote the socialist book about what could happen with the Labour Party in Britain.
In the nationalist book, you talk a lot about immigration. And if I'm not misstating, you say it's okay and acceptable for people to advocate for limits on immigration, that sort of an inescapable part of nationalism and shouldn't be understood as racism. Am I describing your position correctly?
Yeah, the nationalism book is a big disappointment to me because I think a lot of the left just wouldn't touch it. They associate that with Trump. And politically, I think they still don't understand what's wrong with such an idea like open borders, that if you're going to have these huge social policies, people have to be assured that the people who are getting the money and getting the benefits are people who have the same broad values and commitment to the country that they have. You cannot have the idea that just anybody who comes into America, walks across the shore, gets the same benefits as anybody else. It's part of, again, I was amazed when I went to the Labour Party meeting that some of the people there wanted anybody from the EU who happened to be living in Britain to vote in their national elections. This just didn't make any sense to me. And to have a democracy and to have an advanced welfare state, you really have to have an idea that you are part of a nation and you're all in it together. And so you have to have border security. At the same time, you know, we can't have 11 million illegal immigrants in this country who are defenseless and can be exploited by employers. We have to find a path for citizenship. My problem with the Democrats is that they don't at all say anything about border security. So they leave themselves open to all these charges that that they just want to give away benefits to anybody who comes across the border.
When the Trump era ends, I mean, it may never end because he's now saying he's going to serve three terms, and then after that we have Don Jr. and all that. But let's say it ends in this election cycle or the next election cycle. What's the legacy of Trumpism? Does it have a long tail, or is it a sort of weird moment in our politics, of which there have been some in the past too?
I think it's a weird moment to a great extent. I think that his election was a kind of perfect storm, freakish event. The Comey letter, all these various things conspired to bring this guy who'd never been in public office to make him our president, who was really unprepared to be president. And if he loses, I would expect the Republican Party to revert back, for the most part, to the way it was, to the sort of McConnell Republican Party. There is going to be a change in the attitude towards government and active government. Not in taxes, maybe. They're still going to want to give away all the money to the rich. But I think in terms of industrial policy, supporting, promoting growth, I think that's going to become much more part of the Republican agenda. And it's something on which Democrats and Republicans will be able to cooperate. The economic patriotism, I think that will be a legacy of Trump. To some extent, we are going to try to decouple from China and to bring more of our industries home. Whether it's, whether it works out, I'm just not sure, because you can't just legislate that. That's again. So yes, some parts of Trump will remain, but politically it'll go back to some extent to the status quo before Trump.
Can the Democrats get back the Trump voters, especially if the Republicans become more of a Mitch McConnell business kind of party?
Well, I think they'll become business, but I think that we'll have to see how healthcare and things like that work out. I mean, there's a way in which, I remember in the 90s, and you remember this too, that Grover Norquist and Bill Kristol and people like that feared that if Clinton got his healthcare plan, the Democrats would be in power forever. Because, it would be like Social Security, it would become another third rail. And then with Obama, we thought, Obamacare, but it turned out exactly the opposite, that it ended up screwing up the Democrats. So again, it really depends what how the Biden people conduct themselves. It's just as likely to me that we could be back to a Republican, but a more moderate one in 2024.
Again, John Judas's new book is called The Socialist Awakening: What's Different Now About the Left. You can find links to buy this book and the other titles in this series on our website at globalreports.columbia.edu or by subscribing to Columbia Global Reports at globalreports.columbia.edu/subscribe. I'm Nick Lemon for Columbia Global Reports. Thank you for listening.